Welcome, everybody, to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Brett Haber, and today we add a new continent to our collection on the Tennis Worthy Podcast. Since the inception of the series in January of 23, we've brought you interviews with Australians and Europeans and Americans and one person from Asia, and you can hear all those interviews at tennisfame.com/podcast. We had no one, though, from Africa until right now. Today, we put that right with our interview with the Hall of Famer recognized for his contributions to tennis, the South African Cliff Drysdale.
And I looked into the face of Robert Kennedy. That was one of those unforgettable moments in my career. I think if somebody had shown up with a coach in my era with the Australians, you know, Emerson, Starlee, Newcomb, Roach, Laver, Rosewood, they would have said, hey, mate, what is this? What's this coaching thing here? It's a matter of motivation. It's a matter of getting on the right track. It's a matter of having the right people around you and putting in the hard work. The telephone call with Mike Gibson, the Monday morning of Wimbledon, 83 names, I think I read to him. These gentlemen are pulling out of the gentlemen's singles.
Drysdale is a contributor thanks to his crucial role as the male player spokesman in the 1973 Wimbledon boycott. Allied to several decades of work as a highly respected TV commentator, but he was also, as you will certainly recall, a high-level player. He was runner-up to Manolo Santana at Forest Hills in 1965. He won the U.S. Open men's doubles title with Roger Taylor in 1972. Yet, he was entirely self-taught, unless you call the practice wall with which he had conversations a teacher. So, Cliff Drysdale is not just a great character and officially a handsome fellow. He is also a fascinating subject for the Tennis Worthy Podcast, as Chris Bowers found out when he sat down with Cliffy at Wimbledon.
Cliff, what do you think makes a Hall of Famer?
Basically, his results on the tennis court, or hers. I mean, it's pretty simple. If you have had a successful tennis career on the court, then you cannot avoid being a member of the Hall of Fame ultimately. But you've got to have some seriously good results overall. Contributor category is a slightly different thing. There you just have to have made a contribution, meaningful contribution over the years to the sport. And that's the way to get into the Hall of Fame.
I mean, we should point out that you are a contributor rather than in the player category. And yet, as a Grand Slam singles finalist and Grand Slam doubles champion, you've reached the high levels. What has been the biggest attribute that you think has taken you to those heights?
On the court, it was my just natural ability. I wish I could say that it was hard work and dedication and just an overwhelming desire for results. I had those desires for results, but the dedication and those other attributes that I think the modern day champions have, I did not have. For me, it was a matter of playing my match and then trying to relax until I played the next match just so that I would have enough energy to get through another day. I was talented, though. I was talented in different sports. I was a substantially okay cricketer and soccer player, for example. So my genes allowed me to have some natural talent, and I think that took me a long way.
We'll come back to desire a bit later, but tell me how you got into tennis.
Mom and Dad played. Neither one professionally, but they loved the game. Used to take me down to the club where I watched everybody play. Then I begged to play also. I was allowed to go and hit a few balls with my Dunlop Maxpli tennis racket.
How old were you?
I was young, 7, 8 years old. So I would sit by the side of the court with the Dunlop Maxpli because I was so proud of it. I figured that if I was showing that I had this racket, then maybe somebody would ask me to play. I could hit against the wall for hours. And I just loved the feel of the ball on the racket and the moving from one side to the other. Plus, I was always able to beat the wall. I was Eric Sturgis, who was South Africa's best player by a long way at the time when I was looking at those things. And the two of us, we could just beat anybody on the wall. But I played because my parents were tennis players, and they took me to the club.
So when you see today's youngsters hitting forehand after forehand after forehand at the academies that they have in Florida or in Spain, were you actually already doing that, but just of your own passion?
Gee, that's a good question. I certainly wasn't doing it under anybody's direction. I was doing it only under my own auspices. I never took any lessons really to speak of ever until, I suppose, I got on the South African Davis Cup team and Yaroslav Drobny was our captain coach really, when I sort of started to think about the shots. Before that, it didn't occur to me to think about the mechanics of a swing. So when I ended up in Texas near Austin at Lakeway, when I wanted to move to the U.S. permanently from South Africa, one of the things that I was supposed to do was give tennis lessons. At this stage, I was already, you know, I had already been to semifinals, et cetera, et cetera, some of the things that I did on the tennis court. And the tennis pro said, well, you do know basic mechanics of the sport, don't you? I said yes, but the answer is I did not know. I had to learn it all from scratch about how to take the racket back, closed racket face, open face, continental grip volley, etc., or forehand ground stroke, which was the worst shot of my arsenal. Those were all things that I had never really thought about, and I still today sometimes think that if I had had some direction, and if I had had somebody cracking the whip and saying, listen, maybe it would be not a bad idea to go for a run around the block a couple of times to get in better shape than you are, I would have been a more successful player.
So were you entirely self-taught up to the age of about 20?
Entirely self-taught.
So where did you take your... Who did you model yourself on? Where was your input for how to hit a forehand and a backhand?
I didn't. It was the wall. I guess we used to have discussions, the wall and I, about the way to hit. I had a two-handed backhand for a start. That was something that was not exactly unique, but there were very few two-handed backhand players at the highest level of the game. And I used to think that because I had a two-handed backhand, it was somewhat strange, and that it was impossible for me to understand that someone with a two-handed backhand could become one of the best players in the world. I thought, you know, it could take me maybe so far. But nobody else basically was playing with a two-handed backhand. So that was one of the things that I think also held me back. If I'd had somebody who said, this is the shot of the future, I would have been more confident in my own abilities.
Did anybody say to you, Cliffy, you play some nice tennis, but there's no way you're going to get any good with that backhand?
No, but I figured out for myself that it was by far my best shot. And I used to look at players that potentially were coming up for me to play against when I started to tour. And I would look at their serves. And if their serves were not like the second serve particularly, weren't that swift, I would say to myself, no problem with this guy. I'm just going to run around my forehand, whack the two-handed, and come into the net, and that's it. I'm not going to have any problem with this player. So it was purely for me, technically, mechanically, something that came very naturally to me. It doesn't mean that I didn't think about the strategic play, because I did. That was one of them. Give me a short serve and you're toast.
Because you weren't quite the first to hit a two-handed backhand at the highest level. Vivian McGrath in the 30s in Australia, John Bromwich, Pancho Segura would hit a right-handed, two-handed forehand almost. But in those days, we're talking about, what, late 40s, early 50s, when you started hitting, you had no television, I suspect, then. There was nothing to base that on. So who did you base the backhand on?
I had no television, period. There was no television in South Africa when I grew up. I never saw television until I left the country.
So your point of reference was your club, your parents' club?
Yeah, my point of reference really was still the wall. As I said, we used to discuss this and the wall would tell me that I was just a really outstanding, unbeatable player. And I would hit time and time again against it. I was not copying anybody, that's for sure. I think if I had been copying anybody, it would have been somebody like Lou Hode was in my imagination some god that played this game and he had a huge one-handed backhand. I might not have hit a two-handed backhand. So I might have been without the only real shot that was a threat.
What was the best piece of advice the wall gave you?
Have fun. Just come back and keep hitting because this is good for you. It's good exercise. And the more you play with me, the better you're going to get. And I still think that to this day. If I have people who have really young kids, the best thing that you can do for them is show them the garage, give them whatever ball that it takes, let them hit balls against the wall, because it's repetition that makes a champion.
Were you ambidextrous?
Yes, I was ambidextrous. I right-handed on most everything but cricket, golf, baseball with a bat, all left-handed.
So that would make sense of the two-handed backhand.
Yes.
Because you use the same grip for the two-handed backhand as for the golf club, for the cricket bat.
Yes. No, I was absolutely ambidextrous.
Because Rosewall was also ambidextrous. Did you ever discuss that with him or with anyone else on the tour?
No, I didn't. I did have a discussion with his backhand a few times that I would rather not have had, because when we went through this exercise earlier this week of the greatest shots in the history of the sport, I went back to Ken Rosewall that most people, you know, have no idea really who I'm talking about. That's an exaggeration, because they do, because he was historically a great player, but... but he had, to me, still I would put his backhand up there against anybody's.
When you first made it on the tennis tour, tennis was still amateur. Does that mean you had a day job?
No. When I got on the South African Davis Cup team, I think that was 1962. It was, as you said, amateur. The South African Tennis Federation paid for my fare, because I had gone to college in the U.S. thinking that that was where my future was going to be. Then I got on the South African Davis Cup team. They paid my fare to Switzerland, where we played a Davis Cup tie against Switzerland in 1962 in Lausanne. Still have great memories of that place. So it got paid. And I made magnificent some maybe $5 a day from the South African Tennis Association, but they paid all expenses. So I never had a day job. There came a time in 67 when I'd really had enough and I wasn't making any money, and I was sort of entrepreneurial, and I did want to go into business and make life for myself. It was going to be in Johannesburg. And I was about to do it, and then Lamar Hunt came along at the end of, or Dave Dixon, I'm sure you know that story, and signed myself and seven other guys to the euphemistically handsome eight. And that turned it around for me, because he offered me $30,000, $30,000 a year. I had to make it, but if I didn't make it, that's how much I would get. So that was my
first. So it was a guarantee.
That was a guarantee.
So you were out on the tour, but you were funded, basically.
Correct.
Right. You wore a glove, if I remember rightly.
I did, after some years, because playing in the U.S. in the summertime for me was a real challenge, because of all the sweat that would run down my hand into the onto the racket, and then I'd have difficulty holding the racket, et cetera, et cetera. And I wondered why players didn't use a glove. I still, to some extent, wonder why players don't use a glove, because it gave you a really good grip on the racket. And to be perfectly honest, just because I was lazy, it was much easier for me just to take a glove off, put a fresh glove on, than it was to try and do what Roy Emerson did, which was go and dip his racket into the ice cooler and then wipe the water off it, and that would give him a better grip. That was just too much work for me. So anything to make life easier, just change the glove, which I did. So yeah, the reason I did it was because of the heat of the U.S. summer and sweating. And then I got to where I wanted to use it all the time and did.
You said you're quite entrepreneurial in character. Did you ever get your glove sponsored?
I did. This certainly was not why I was wearing it, but SAI, I'm not sure even to this day what it stands for, but it was a company in the U.S., and they said, would you sponsor this glove? And there are some little ads, I think, in World Tennis Magazine or Tennis Magazine at a certain time with my endorsement and for a glove, and I think it's made maybe $3,000 a year for that.
Because I know that your fellow South African and fellow Hall of Famer, Frew McMillan, who wore the white cap every time he played on court, he said after his playing career, I really should have got that sponsored.
Yeah, he probably could have, Fru. But
$3,000 for your glove, he'd have probably been on the same kind of money, I'd have thought.
Yeah. If I had to do it all over again, I would probably, I would have done it for free. I wanted the gloves, was the main thing.
So how many gloves did you have in your bag when you went out for a match?
A dozen.
So you change them every, two or three changes of ends?
Maybe once a set, approximately. But I had plenty there. I had some of them that were dried out and some of them that were brand new. I was very frugal, so I didn't want to overuse them. So I would wash them.
Very good. You mentioned a few minutes ago Eric Sturgis. There was also Owen Williams, who was a South African player. You overlapped with the sort of latter years of Gordon Forbes and Abe Siegel's careers. Were there any idols, icons that played a role in your development, or are you totally self-made, even beyond the self-taught?
On the court, I was a self-made guy. The numbers of people that have helped me throughout my life, Chris, is a staggeringly high number. Gordon Forbes was one of them. Abe Siegel was another one. Owen Williams, probably as much as anyone, because he was a selector for the U.S. for the South African Davis Cup team, and he had the pivotal vote to put me on the team when I was already in the U.S., which was unprecedented. But he voted to have me on the team that was the 1962 year, I believe. But the others that have helped me through the other stages of my life are way too many to mention, to be honest.
Let's take you back to the U.S. Open. Well, it wasn't the U.S. Open. It was the U.S. Nationals at Forest Hills, 1965. You get to the final. You're playing a Spaniard who's moaned about grass being for cows. And he beats you in four sets. What went wrong?
What went wrong was I was playing against Manolo Santana, who is from Spain, and I never did beat him under any circumstances until we got to like 35 and over match, and he was way past his prime, and I was close to past my prime, and we played one in South Africa. It was the only time I ever beat him. I played against him not only in the final of the US Open, but in other major matches, including Davis Cup in Johannesburg in front of a home crowd, and he used to toy with me. He was a truly brilliant player. He could slice, he could topspin, I don't think there's anybody who hit a topspin forehand and backhand equally as well as Manolo did. So I never knew what was coming next. Nothing happened that day particularly. The only little story that I will tell you is that it rained after a couple of sets. I think it was a four-set match, and after maybe two or three sets it rained. And there was an area underneath the stadium where at Forest Hills where the players could go and lie down, which I took advantage of, lay down, and fell asleep. And then I felt this person waking me up, shaking my shoulder. Turned out, and I looked into the face of Robert Kennedy.
Who was a presidential candidate, or about to be at that stage.
Moment I will never forget. And this was his handler or his bodyguard or something. And he said, yeah, I just wanted to say hello. And he presented the prize. Unfortunately, it was second prize for me. But that was one of those unforgettable moments in my career.
Great achievement getting to the final. But given that you did that at, 23? You talked earlier about, did I quite have the desire? I mean, should you have done more after that? If you had a bit more desire, would you perhaps have achieved more?
If I had somebody to motivate me, if I'd had somebody who said, listen, this is what you need to do, I would have wondered why. Because, you know, the maximum that I could have made in those days was like $500 under the table from a tournament in Lebanon or Turkey or something like that. There were not big bucks in it for amateurs, which is, I was an amateur in those days. But still, I really regret that I didn't at some point have somebody or come to the conclusion myself that I should say, whoa, why not, while you're doing this thing anyway, why not become the best that you can be? And yeah, dedicate yourself to getting in spectacular shape, learn a little bit more about the mechanics of this game, and go from there and see really what you can achieve. I regret that.
But then doesn't motivation come from within? Even if you've got a coach says, come on, you need to do this, run around the block three times, go to the gym, hit 1,000 balls. Ultimately, it's got to come from inside you, hasn't it?
Yes, but Chris, nobody had traveling coaches in those days. The first guy to do it was the next generation of players with Bjorn Borg. I played Bjorn maybe twice or so, but he was, to me, he was the generation after me. And he, you know, had Leonard Berglund come with him. But before that, there wasn't really anybody that was on the tour. Nobody had. I think if somebody had shown up with a coach in my era with the Australians, you know, Emerson, Starley, Newcomb, Roach, Laver, Rosewell, they would have said, "Hey, mate, what is this? What's this coaching thing here?"
So it was almost like it was uncool to be professional.
Oh, I don't think that. No, I wouldn't go that far. It was uncool to act like you needed to have somebody hold your hand and take you through the day and take you through a match. For us, it was definitely a case of you're out there, you're on your own. And in the case of the Australians, if you're out there, you're not injured. And you certainly don't make any excuses. That's the truth of that era.
Because it's interesting. I'm trying to work out whether someone of your mindset would get very far now. But at the same time, I find myself thinking, have we gone too far the other way? That actually too much is done for players and that they don't take enough responsibility for what they do.
I would have got any player today who had my attitude that time would have got nowhere. It would have been a total disaster. That said, those were completely different times, and I was competing against players who had basically the same attitude that I had. I suppose that's not being fair to Harry Hopman, because he was the motivational leader of the Australians, and I think he was definitely a part of what made so many of the Australians great players in those days, and he did motivate them, and he knew how to motivate them and what to get them to do. And I never had that from the South African standpoint. We never had a coach with that kind of vigor and verve. So, no, it would not work today. Today, it's much more professional, and Novak Djokovic is the prime example of somebody who dedicates his life in the way that I wish I would have done, which is basically every breath you take is toward one objective, and that is to make yourself a better tennis player, which in turn means you have to be superhumanly fit, and you have to work so hard at this game and continually improve your stroke production.
When tennis went open in 1968, did you feel greater motivation because the money was greater, because you were treated as professionals? Because if you look at your best singles, individual singles result, you beat Rod Laver in the US Open in 1968.
And he won the Grand Slam the following year.
Yes, there you go.
And Arthur Ashe won it in 68. And if I hadn't beaten Rod Laver in that tournament...
We're polishing your medals, Cliff, but... Did the motivation change?
No.
Okay.
My motivation did not. It was like just a glorious little gift at the end of what I thought was going to be the end of my tennis career, that somebody was going to give me $30,000 guaranteed to play the sport. Because there isn't any way I could have gone and gotten a job in South Africa that would have come close to that. So to me, it was just like a little lease on life, and thank you very much. It should have been more motivation, but it still was a little while before the real professionals showed up.
So signing up for the Handsome Eight a year before tennis went open, that wasn't a big gamble for you. That was what, like a windfall?
Yes, it was like, thank you very much. I'm really glad for this opportunity to keep playing. And then the game opened up that because of the signing the eight, which and then joined in the other group, which was National Tennis League, which was Emerson and Starley and Laver, and that group's a bit the two groups together really opened the entire sport up. And that's all she wrote. From there on in, there was the tennis boom, and we went from there.
We'll come back to the tennis boom in a minute, but your entry onto the Grand Slam Roll of Honour came in 1972 when you won the US Open men's doubles with Roger Taylor. What did that mean to you?
It should have meant a heck of a lot more than it did at the time, because after that, years later, I was able to say, you won a Grand Slam title. I had been to the final at Forest Hills, as you said. I'd been to the semifinals a couple of times at the French and Wimbledon, but that was the only Grand Slam title that I had. And it's nice to be able to say that, Chris. it was not a major motivation for me to continue doing anything. It was just like we were playing. It was against Owen Davidson and John Newcomb in the final, and they were buddies, and it just was what it was. We were able to win a major doubles.
You make it sound like a club match.
But it was. The way that we treat this sport with such reverence now, I think, is terrific. It's wonderful, and it has become so much bigger and so much... It has so much more of an effect on people's lives because of the nature of the television business and how you can expand the horizons of everybody that's watching, for example, and playing. But it wasn't like that for me in those days, and I truly don't think that a guy like Roy Emerson was counting his Grand Slams and saying, gee, if I'm going to win another one, I'm going to have 13 Grand Slams, so I'm going to go down into history as one of the most prolific Grand Slam winners of all time. I'm sure he wasn't counting them. In fact, I've been talking with Chrissy Everett, who has considerably more, and even she is not that familiar with her history. She's very proud of what she's done, obviously. But in those early days... It just was what it was. If you won a Grand Slam, you won a Grand Slam. But it wasn't like, okay, this is just one of all those extra slams that I'm going to win.
I wonder if that took pressure off you. And I wonder if that's an option for people to say, I'm not going to count my titles. I'm just going to go out and play the ball.
Can't do it anymore. We've got way too many people that are interested in it, who are looking at it. And you cannot do that anymore. Everybody's following every movement that you make. And when you lose, it is a major disaster. And when you win, you are given everything on a silver platter. It is a different world, Chris.
Going back to 72-73, you were the first president of the Association of Tennis Professionals. So here's somebody from a moderately affluent background in South Africa, entrepreneurial in spirit, as you've said, becoming effectively a trade union official. How did you slip into that role?
Again, this was like almost everything else in my life. This is something that I just slid into. It was not something that I was looking to do. I was a locker room politician with the other players. This is too long a story for us to go into in this format. But the bottom line is that the players began to realize that we were going to go back under the yoke of people other than ourselves. The International Tennis Federation was looking to expand or to recapture what they had lost through the turn toward professional tennis, and to determine what players could and couldn't do, and the professionals weren't going to do it. So we had discussions in the locker room about it. There was unanimous agreement between players who were still amateurs, those who were contract pros. Again, this is too complicated a conversation. And then there were pros who had signed contracts for professional living. And we all agreed on one thing, and that is that we did not want to go back to the days of when the International Tennis Federation controlled every move you made. So that's why it happened. And I happened to be there at the time and was interested in it and spoke to the players about it, got no opposition. There wasn't anybody who didn't see that what the track that we were about to take was the wrong track. Everybody knew we didn't want to go back.
And then within a year of the Association of Tennis Professionals being founded, you had a major battleground where Nicky Pilic was denied the chance to play a couple of Grand Slam tournaments because he hadn't played Davis Cup. And you were absolutely centre of attention, not just of the tennis world, but the whole media world, because there was a question of almost 100 players boycotting Wimbledon.
Yeah, it wasn't two Grand Slams. It was just Wimbledon. The French allowed him to play. Again, this is too long a story for this format, but the Yugoslav Federation banned Nicky Pilic from playing in any sanctioned tournaments because he wouldn't agree to play Davis Cup for him. But he was a professional, so that wasn't on the cards for us, and everybody in the locker room agreed with the principle that we were not going to go back to those days when the ITF would control the players, and Wimbledon backed the ITF. So it was the French did not, the Italians did not, and just weeks later, Wimbledon did. And, the ATP, we went in to try to have the law courts force Wimbledon to allow Nicky Pilic to play, which we were not successfully doing. And so the telephone call with Mike Gibson, the Monday morning of Wimbledon, 83 names, I think I read to him. These gentlemen are pulling out of the gentlemen's singles.
And how did you feel as somebody whose life had been predominantly tennis about leading a boycott, as much as you did lead it, of the most prestigious tournament?
Very disappointing for you to have to listen to what I'm saying, because these were things that just happened. It's not like I thought that I was on the brink of something historic. This was something that was necessary to do at the time, and we were going to do it regardless. I did not see myself as a historical figure in the birth of professional tennis, or at least the containment of what we had built up already and wanted to maintain. So it was not a born again moment for me. It just happened. We did it. I was proud of it. I didn't for one second look back and say, "Gee, we should have done something differently," because I don't think we should.
You had discussions with the British sports minister, who was a former Newsweek columnist, I think. You had discussions with lawyers. Did you occasionally have moments of thinking, this is surreal, I'm playing tennis and here we are? However much I get what you're saying about the, you know, this needed to happen, but it's a strange environment for a tennis player to be thrust into.
No, you're trying to goad me into making statements that will make it sound better to you. Yeah, this guy really realizes he was on the cusp of something. That's not what happened. We were just trying our damnedest to get Wimbledon to allow Nicky Pilic to play and not to bow to the Yugoslav Federation's request. And they refused to do that. And it wasn't more than 10 days after this whole process happened that everything changed, and that they realized that they needed to include the players in the decision-making process of professional sports, and they did. So there was never anything that even came close to that again, ever.
One of the things that I picked up researching that era was that your whole approach was far more in sorrow than in anger. There was actually very little militancy about it.
No, it's... Again, it was just so natural and so normal. I wasn't upset with it. I think more disbelief that the authorities wouldn't see it our way and not realize that they were making a mistake going forward.
And when you look back on it now, do you just see it as something that, well, just a growing pain that professional tennis had to go through?
Yeah, but it was. That is exactly what it was. It would have happened anyway. It would have taken a little longer. But professional tennis was definitely on the way. Professional golf had been a huge success. Professional sports, period, basketball, football in the U.S., were huge successes, soccer, football in this country. So there was no doubt in my mind that we were headed in that direction. We still continue, even at this stage, to have, you know, wonder about exactly where it's headed, because there are always going to be little bumps in the road. Now we're talking about the Saudis injecting money into tennis, or what do you do about that? I'm not part of that conversation, but it's just interesting that it continues.
The result of the victory of the players in the boycott was the formation of the Men's International Professional Tennis Council, and yet you didn't really stay around as a player for that long. Do you wish in retrospect you'd had a little longer on the pro circuit that came out of the Wimbledon clash?
You know, we've talked about it, Chris. I was a good player. I was a great player. You're talking about whether I would want it to continue to play as a professional. One thing led to another in my life, and I got to the stage where naturally most of my friends, you know, when you got to 35, 36, it was like, okay, now you've had a good time, maybe move on and let the younger kids have a go at this thing. And that's fundamentally what I did. And then just purely by chance, again, seems like everything in my life was by chance, which saved me from doing something completely different from my life and staying in tennis, which is when Le Mans signed us. This time, it was the television business. So here I was, and I was ready to... Then cable TV came along, this strange animal that nobody quite understood what it meant. But I was on the... I was in the birthing stages of cable, certainly a sports cable, and I joined ESPN, and that was 50 years ago, and I'm still let's be more accurate, like 42 or 43 years ago when ESPN was first on the air. The first week they were on the air, I was on the air with them. And again, that's just something that happened. So here I am still just zigzagging along, slithering along in my life, and these things have just happened to me.
Is part of your recipe for success a bit of self-deprecation?
Maybe. I mean, I do talk a lot about the self-effacing European thing. I don't think that's true of me. I think I have a lot of confidence in my abilities to get with people and to motivate them. I do think I have that. But maybe a little bit of that, but truly not. I think I'm being as honest as I can. Why wouldn't I be? I have sort of drifted through these different things. I've made an impression in a lot of different ways in the sport, from player to now broadcaster, and then, as you'd like to put me, like labor leader, which I have difficulty with that.
I've explored it. I'm not sort of wanting to label you as anything.
That's okay. That's fine. It makes me more rounded.
Well, yes, because, I mean, one thinks of the entrepreneurial spirit as being in conflict with the trade union. And so having done both roles, it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I still have an entrepreneurial spirit, and I'm way past being at that entrepreneurial time. I need to relax now.
So when in 2013 the International Tennis Hall of Fame said you've been voted to be inducted as a contributor, what was the feeling that you had at that point?
It was part of me felt that for all of the things that I had done, that was a really, really cool recognition of those things. I was not inducted as because of my playing abilities, because I didn't have a resume that would have allowed me to get into the Hall of Fame. But it was very nice that, given all of these things that we've talked about and the variety of ways that I've contributed, that I was allowed to become a contributor.
I almost wanted to ask you whether you felt a degree of imposter syndrome, given that you've said throughout this interview, well, I wasn't that good. I didn't do that much for on the Wimbledon boycott. I just sort of stood for what we players needed.
I wouldn't call myself an imposter. If you'd used a more gentle word, I might have gone along with it. But I was not an imposter.
Imposter syndrome, I meant. Feeling that people have when they sort of, am I being overpraised?
No, I understand that. I understand what you're trying to say. When you put the whole bag of tricks that's been my life together, it was just a nice recognition. I don't think that I feel like I didn't deserve it, for example. I was just really happy to be a part of a group of people that I really admired.
So you can recognise that you have contributed a lot to tennis through the broadcasting and the playing.
Yes, and the ATP formation.
Yeah. What advice do you give to today's youngsters and or their parents? Or would you give if they asked you?
For those who wanted to become professional tennis players or just live life's lessons?
Well, both.
Get the best. First of all, get a tennis ball and get a wall and get a racket that can hit the ball sufficiently well, and go out there and hit a million tennis balls before you even think about anything else. Then get a good coach and somebody who can guide you properly.
So that part of your upbringing is still valid for today's world?
I think it
world.
Is still valid for today. And then I think you have to be so dedicated if you want to become a professional tennis player that somebody has got to motivate you to be that dedicated. There are a lot of people, and myself included, who did it just because we loved the ball, and I loved running, and I loved hitting the ball, and that is a really good start. But at a certain point, get somebody who really knows what they're doing that can tell you exactly how to hit the ball and how to get in shape to play this game. As for life's lessons, that's not my subject that I think I could make much sense about.
I mean, the reason I asked you about the tennis is that obviously you have a lot of experience. And yet you spent a fair bit of this interview saying, well, the world of tennis is totally different. But a lot of the principles that got you motivated as a kid to hit that ball against the wall are still relevant to today's kids.
There's no doubt about that. And that's not only true of tennis. It's true of almost any sport that you could name as well. It's a matter of motivation. It's a matter of getting on the right track. It's a matter of having the right people around you and putting in the hard work.
And how do you find that balance, or how would you encourage others to find the balance between the drive of those who are assisting young players and the young players' motivation themselves?
Such a difficult question to answer, because you have people who have that natural motivation and who know. Novak Djokovic said when he was 7 years old that he wanted to be the best player in the world. He was motivated. Nobody had to tell him to become motivated. He just needed somebody to guide him on that path to success. For those who are not that motivated, there are a lot who are not, and that were late bloomers, and that were sort of guided at a certain time and said, hey, this, I might be pretty good at this because I'm good generally athletically, and if somebody would guide me in this direction of tennis, a professional tennis, I would go for it.
Cliff Drysdale, thank you very much for sharing your reflections on your career and your mindset.
Thank you, sir.
The fascinating and charismatic Cliff Drysdale in conversation with Chris Bowers. And isn't it fascinating to think that the Australian players of the 1960s felt that anyone with a traveling coach at the time was being given an unfair advantage? What would they make of today's top players, we wonder, who don't so much have traveling coaches as traveling entourages? Hope you enjoyed that chat with a man who spanned the amateur and professional eras of tennis. Do please tell your friends and family and folks at your club and anyone who might be interested about these tennis-worthy podcast interviews. And as you'll have worked out, you don't have to be a diehard tennis fan to get something out of these chats with legends. You just have to be someone who's interested in fascinating people. The Tennis-Worthy Podcast is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame in association with the Tennis Radio Network. I'm Brett Haber. Thanks so much for listening, and we look forward to your company next time.